We were going to slip out of the city under the cover of darkness, and Galbatorix was only supposed to find out what had happened once it was too late to catch us. He knew from the very start, though. How, I'm not sure, but I guess he was scrying me the whole while. When Tornak and I went through the gate, we found soldiers waiting for us on the other side. Their orders were to bring us back unharmed, but we fought, and one of them killed Tornak. The finest swordsman in all the Empire, brought down by a knife in the back. But Galbatorix let you escape. I don't think he expected us to fight. Besides, his attention was directed elsewhere that night. She frowned as she saw the oddest half-smile appear on Murtagh's face. I counted the days, he said. That was when the Razak were in Palancar Valley, searching for Saphira's egg. So you see, Aragorn lost his foster father almost at the same time I lost mine. Fate has a cruel sense of humour, don't you think? Yes, it does. But if Galbatorix could scry you, why didn't he track you down and bring you back to Urabain later on? He was playing with me, I think. I went to stay at the estate of a man I believed I could trust. As usual, I was mistaken, though I only found that out later, once the twins brought me back here. Galbatorix knew where I was, and he knew I was still angry over Tornak's death, so he was content to leave me at the estate while he hunted for Aragorn and Brom. I surprised him, though. I left, and by the time he learned of my disappearance, I was already on my way to Drasleona. That's why Galbatorix went to Drasleona, you know. It wasn't to chastise Lord Tabor over his behaviour, although he certainly did. It was to find me. But he was too late. By the time he arrived at the city, I had already met up with Aragorn and Saphira, and we had set off for Gilead. Why did you leave? She asked. Didn't Aragorn tell you? Because, no, not Drasleona. Why did you leave the estate? You were safe there, or so you thought. So why did you leave? Murtagh was quiet for a while. I wanted to strike back at Galbatorix. And I wanted to make a name for myself, apart from my father's. My whole life, people have looked at me differently because I am the son of Morzan. I wanted them to respect me for my deeds, not his. He finally looked at her, a quick glance out of the corner of one eye. I suppose I got what I wanted. But again, fate has a cruel sense of humour. She wondered if there had been anyone else in Galbatorix's court whom he had cared for, but she decided it would be a dangerous topic to broach. So instead she asked, "How much does Galbatorix really know about the Varden?" "Everything, so far as I can tell. He has more spies than you think." She pressed her arms against her belly as her gut twisted. "Do you know of any way to kill him?" "A knife, a sword, an arrow, poison, magic, the usual ways. The problem is, he has too many spells wound about himself for anyone or anything to have a chance of harming him. Aragorn is luckier than most. Galbatorix doesn't want to kill him, so he may get to attack the king more than once. But even if Aragorn could attack him 100 times, he wouldn't find a way past Galbatorix's wards. Every puzzle has a solution, and every man has a weakness," Nasawada insisted. "Does he love any of his concubines?" The look on Murtagh's face answered her well enough. Then he said, "Would it be so bad if Galbatorix remains king? The world he envisions is a good world. If he defeats the Varden, the whole of Alagazia will finally be at peace. He'll put an end to the misuse of magic. Elves, dwarves, and humans will no longer have cause to hate each other. What's more, if the Varden lose, Aragorn and I can be together as brothers ought to be. But if they win, it'll mean the death of Thorne and me. It'll have to." "Oh, and what of me?" she asked. "If Galbatorix wins, shall I become his slave, to order about as he wills?" Murtagh refused to answer, but she saw the tendons on the back of his hands tighten. "You can't give up, Murtagh." "What other choice do I have?" he shouted, filling the room with echoes. She stood and stared down at him. "You can fight. Look at me. Look at me. He reluctantly lifted his gaze. You can find ways to work against him. That's what you can do. Even if your oaths will allow you only the smallest of rebellions might still prove to be his undoing. She restated his question for effect. What other choice do you have? You can go around feeling helpless and miserable for the rest of your life. You can let Galbatorix turn you into a monster, or you can fight. She spread her arms so that he could see all of the burn marks on her. Do you enjoy hurting me? No, he exclaimed. Then fight, blast you! You have to fight, or you will lose everything you are, as will Thorn. She held her ground as he sprang to his feet, lithe as a cat, and moved toward her until he was only a few inches away. The muscles in his jaw bunched and knotted while he glowered at her, breathing heavily through his nostrils. She recognized his expression, for it was one she had seen many times before. His was the look of a man whose pride had been offended, and who wanted to lash out at the person who had insulted him. It was dangerous to keep pushing him, but she knew she had to, for she might never get the chance again. If I can keep fighting, she said, then so can you. Back to the stone, he said in a harsh voice. I know you're not a coward, Murtagh. Better to die than to live as a slave to one such as Galbatorix. At least then you might accomplish some good, and your name might be remembered with a measure of kindness after you're gone. Back to the stone, he growled, grabbing her by the arm and dragging her over to the slab. She allowed him to push her onto the ash-colored block, fasten the restraints around her wrists and ankles, and then tighten the strap around her head. When he finished, he stood looking at her, his eyes dark and wild, the lines of his body like cords stretched taut. You have to decide whether you are willing to risk your life in order to save yourself, she said. You and Thorn both. And you have to decide now, while there is still time. Ask yourself, what would Tornak have wanted you to do? Without answering, Murtagh extended his right arm and placed his hand upon the upper part of her chest, his palm hot against her skin. Her breath hitched at the shock of the contact. Then, hardly louder than a whisper, he began to speak in the ancient language. As the strange words tumbled from his lips, her fear grew ever stronger. He spoke for what seemed like minutes. She felt no different when he stopped, but that was neither a favorable nor an unfavorable sign where magic was concerned. Cool air washed over the patch on her chest, chilling it as Murtagh lifted his hand away. He stepped back then and started to walk past her toward the entrance of the chamber. She was about to call out to him to ask what he had done to her, when he paused and said, "That should shield you from the pain of most any wound. But you'll have to pretend otherwise, or Galbatorix will discover what I've done." And then he left. Thank you, she whispered to the empty room. She spent a long time pondering their conversation. It seemed unlikely that Galbatorix had sent Murtagh to talk with her, but unlikely or not, it remained a possibility. Also, she found herself torn as to whether Murtagh was, at heart, a good person or a bad one. She thought back to King Hrothgar, who had been like an uncle to her when she was growing up, and how Murtagh had killed him on the Burning Plains. Then she thought of Murtagh's childhood and the many hardships he had faced, and how he had allowed Aragorn and Saphira to go free when he could have just as easily brought them to Urabane. Yet even if Murtagh had once been honorable and trustworthy, she knew that his enforced servitude might have corrupted him. In the end, she decided she would ignore Murtagh's past and judge him on his actions in the present, and those alone. Good, bad, or some combination thereof, he was a potential ally, and she needed his help if she could get it. If he proved false, then she would be no worse off than she already was. But if he proved true, then she might be able to escape from Urubane, and that was well worth the risk. In the absence of pain, She slept long and deep for the first time since her arrival at the capital. She awoke, feeling more hopeful than before, and again fell to tracing the lines painted on the ceiling. The thin blue line she was following led her to notice a small white shape on the corner of a tile that she had previously overlooked. It took her a moment to realize that the discoloration was where a chip had fallen free. The sight amused her, for she found it humorous and somewhat comforting to know that Galbatorix's perfect chamber was not quite so perfect after all, and that despite his pretensions otherwise, he was not omniscient or infallible. When the door to the chamber next opened, it was her jailer, bringing what she guessed was a midday meal. She asked him if she could eat first, before he let her up, for she said she was more hungry than anything else, which was not entirely untrue. To her satisfaction, he agreed, though he uttered not a word, only smiled his hideous, clamp-like smile, and seated himself on the edge of the slab. As he spooned warm gruel into her mouth, her mind raced as she tried to plan for every contingency, for she knew she would have only one chance at success. Anticipation made it difficult for her to stomach the bland food. Nevertheless, she managed, and when the bowl was empty and she had drunk her fill, she readied herself. The man had, as always, placed the food tray by the base of the far wall, close to where Murtagh had been sitting, and perhaps 10 feet from the door to the privy room. Once she was free of her manacles, she slid off the block of stone. The gourd-headed man reached over to take hold of her left arm, but she raised a hand, and in her sweetest voice said, "I can stand by myself now. Thank you." The jailer hesitated. Then he smiled again and clacked his teeth together twice, as if to say, "Well then, I'm happy for you." They started toward the privy room, she in the front and he slightly to the rear. As she took her third step, she deliberately twisted her right ankle and stumbled diagonally across the room. The man shouted and tried to catch her. She felt his thick fingers close on the air above her neck, but he was too slow, and she eluded his grasp. She fell lengthwise onto the tray, breaking the pitcher, which still held a fair amount of watered wine, and sending the wooden bowl clattering across the floor. By design, she landed with her right hand underneath her, and as soon as she felt the tray, she began to search with her fingers for the metal spoon. "Ah!" she exclaimed, as if hurt, then turned to look up at the man, doing her best to appear chagrined. "Maybe I wasn't ready after all," she said, and gave him an apologetic smile. Her thumb touched the handle of the spoon, and she grabbed hold of it, even as the man pulled her upright by her other arm. He looked her over and wrinkled his nose, appearing disgusted by her wine-soaked shift. While he did, she reached behind herself and slid the handle of the spoon through a hole near the hem of her garment. Then she held up her hand, as if to show that she had taken nothing. The man grunted, grabbed her other arm, and marched her to the privy room. As she entered, he shuffled back toward the tray, muttering under his breath. The moment she had closed the door, she pulled the spoon out of her shift and placed it between her lips, holding it there as she plucked several strands of hair from the back of her head, where they were longest. Moving as fast as she could, she pinched one end of the gathered hairs between the fingers of her left hand, and then rolled the loose strands down her thighs with the palm of her right, twisting them together into a single cord. Her skin grew cold as she realized the cord was too short. Fumbling in her urgency, she tied off the ends, then placed the cord on the ground. She plucked another group of hairs and rolled them into a second cord, which she tied off like the first. Knowing that she had only seconds remaining, she dropped to one knee and knotted the two strands together. Then she took the spoon from her mouth, and with the slim length of thread, she bound the spoon to the outside of her left leg, where the edge of her shift would cover it. It had to go on her left leg, because Galbatorix always sat to her right. She stood and checked that the spoon remained hidden, and then she took a few steps to make sure it would not fall. It did not. Relieved, she allowed herself to exhale. Now her challenge was to return to the slab without letting her jailer notice what she had done. The man was waiting for her when she opened the door to the privy room. He scowled at her, and his sparse eyebrows met, forming a single straight line. "Spoon," he said, mashing the word with his tongue as if it were a piece of overcooked parsnip. She lifted her chin and pointed toward the rear of the privy room. His scowl deepened. He went into the room and carefully examined the walls, floors, ceiling, and all else before stomping back out. He clacked his teeth together again and scratched his bulbous head, appearing unhappy and, she thought, a little hurt that she would bother to throw away the spoon. She had been kind to him, and she knew an act of such petty defiance would puzzle him and make him angry. She resisted the urge to pull away when he stepped forward, put his weighty hands on her head, and combed through her hair with his fingers. When he did not find the spoon, his face drooped. He grabbed her arm then, and walked her over to the slab, and again placed her in the manacles. Then, his expression sullen, he picked up the tray and shuffled out of the room. She waited until she was absolutely sure he was gone, before she reached out with the fingers of her left hand, and inch by inch, pulled up the edge of her shift. A broad smile passed across her face, as she felt the bowl of the spoon with the tip of her index finger. Now she had a weapon. A crown of ice and snow. When the first pale rays of light streaked across the surface of the dimpled sea, illuminating the crests of the translucent waves, which glittered as if carved from crystal, then Aragorn roused himself from his waking dreams and looked to the northwest, curious to see what the light revealed of the clouds building in the distance. What he beheld was disconcerting. The clouds encompassed nearly half the horizon, and the largest of the dense white plumes looked as tall as the peaks of the Beor Mountains, too tall for Saphira to climb over. The only open sky lay behind her, and even that would be lost to them as the arms of the storm closed in.
"We shall have to fly through it," Leda said,
and Aragorn felt Saphira's trepidation.
"Why not try to go around?"
she asked. Through Saphira, Aragorn was aware of Glada examining the structure of the clouds. At last, the golden dragon said,
"I do not want you flying too far off course. We still have many leagues to cover, and if your strength fails you, then you can lend me yours to keep us aloft." "Humph. Even so, it is best to be cautious in our recklessness. I have seen the likes of this storm before. It is larger than you think. To skirt it, we would have to fly so far to the west that you would end up beyond Froengard, and it would probably take another day to reach land."
"The distance to Froengard isn't that great," she said.
"No, but the wind will slow us. Besides, my instincts tell me that the storm extends all the way to the island. One way or another, we shall have to fly through it. However, there's no need to go through its very heart. Do you see the notch between those two small pillars off to the west?"
"Yes."
"Go there, and perhaps we can then find a safe path through the clouds."
Aragorn grasped the front of the saddle as Saphira dropped her left shoulder and turned westward, aiming herself toward the notch Glada had indicated. He yawned and rubbed his eyes as she leveled out. Then he twisted round and dug out an apple and a few strips of dried beef from the bags strapped behind him. It was a meager breakfast, but his hunger was slight, and eating a large meal while riding Saphira often made him queasy. While he ate, he alternated between watching the clouds and gazing at the sparkling sea. He found it unsettling that there was nothing but water beneath them, and that the nearest solid ground, the mainland, was by his estimate over 50 miles away. He shivered as he imagined sinking down and down into the cold, clutching depths of the sea. He wondered what lay at the bottom, and it occurred to him that with his magic, he could likely travel there and find out. But the thought held no appeal. The watery abyss was too dark and too dangerous for his liking. It was not, he felt, a place where his sort of life ought to venture. Better, instead, to leave it to whatever strange creatures already lived there. As the morning wore on, it became apparent that the clouds were farther away than they had first seemed, and that, as Glader had said, the storm was larger than either Aragorn or Saphira had originally imagined. A light headwind sprang up, and Saphira's flight became somewhat more laboured, but she continued to make good progress. When they were still some leagues from the leading edge of the storm, Saphira surprised Aragorn and Glader by slipping into a shallow dive and flying down close to the surface of the water. As she descended, Glader said,
"Saphira, what are you about?"
"I'm curious," she replied, "and I would like to rest my wings before entering the clouds."
She skimmed over the waves, her reflection below and her shadow in front, mirroring her every move like two ghostly companions, one dark and one light. Then she swiveled her wings on edge, and with three quick flaps slowed herself and landed upon the water. A fan of spray shot up on either side of her neck as her chest ploughed into the waves, sprinkling Aragorn with hundreds of droplets. The water was cold, but after so long aloft, the air felt pleasantly warm. So warm, in fact, that Aragorn unwrapped his cloak and pulled off his gloves. Saphira folded her wings and floated along peacefully, bobbing up and down with the motion of the waves. Aragorn spotted several clumps of brown seaweed off to the right. The plants were branched like scrub brush and had berry-sized bladders at joints along the stems. Far overhead, near the height Saphira had been, Aragorn spotted a pair of albatrosses with black-tipped wings, flying away from the massive wall of clouds. The sight only deepened his unease. The seabirds reminded him of the time he had seen a pack of wolves running alongside a herd of deer, as the animals fled a forest fire in the spine. "If we had any sense," he said to Saphira, "we would turn around."
"If we had any sense, we would leave Alagaesia and never return," she rejoined.
Arching her neck, she dipped her muzzle into the seawater, then shook her head and ran her crimson tongue in and out of her mouth several times, as if she had tasted something unpleasant. Then Aragorn felt a sense of panic from Glader, and the old dragon roared in his mind,
"Take off! Now, now, now! Take off!"
Saphira wasted no time on questions. With a sound like thunder, she opened her wings and began to beat them as she reared out of the water. Leaning forward, Aragorn grabbed the edge of the saddle to keep from being thrown backward. The flapping of Saphira's wings threw up a screen of mist that half blinded him, so he used his mind to search for whatever had alarmed Glader. From deep below, rising towards Saphira's underside faster than Aragorn would have believed possible, he felt something that was cold and huge and filled with a ravenous, insatiable hunger. He tried to frighten it, tried to turn it away, but the creature was alien and implacable, and seemed not to notice his efforts. In the strange, lightless caverns of its consciousness, he glimpsed memories of uncounted years spent lurking alone in the icy sea, hunting and being hunted. His own panic mounting, Aragorn groped for the hilt of Brisinger, even as Saphira wrenched herself free from the grasp of the water and began to climb into the air.
"Saphira, hurry!"
he silently shouted. She slowly gained speed and altitude, and then a fountain of white water erupted behind her, and Aragorn saw a pair of shiny grey jaws emerge from within the plume. The jaws were large enough for a horse and rider to pass through unscathed, and were filled with hundreds of glinting white teeth. Saphira was aware of what he saw, and she twisted violently to the side in an attempt to escape the gaping maw, clipping the water with the tip of her wing. An instant later, Aragorn heard and felt the creature's jaws snap shut. The needle-like teeth missed Saphira's tail by inches. As the monster fell back into the water, more of its body became visible. The head was long and angular. A bony crest jutted out over the eyes, and from the outer part of each crest grew a ropey tendril that Aragorn guessed to be over 6 feet in length. The neck of the creature reminded him of a giant rippling snake. What was visible of the creature's torso was smooth and powerfully built, and looked incredibly dense. A pair of oar-shaped flippers extended from the sides of its chest, flailing helplessly in the air. The creature landed upon its side, and a second, even larger burst of spray flew toward the sky. Just before the waves closed over the monster's shape, Aragorn looked into its one upward-facing eye, which was as black as a drop of tar. The malevolence contained therein, the sheer hate and fury and frustration that he perceived in the creature's unblinking gaze was enough to make Aragorn shiver and wish he were in the center of the Haderach Desert, for only there, he felt, would he be safe from the creature's ancient hunger. Heart pounding, he relaxed his grip on Brisinger and slumped over the front of the saddle.
What was that?
A Nidwal,
said Glaedah. Aragorn frowned. He did not remember reading about any such thing in Ella's Mirror.
And what is a Nidwal?
They are rare and not often spoken about. They are to the sea what the Fanghur are to the air. Both are cousins to the dragons. Though the differences in our appearance are greater, the Nidwal are closer to us than are the screeching Fanghur. They are intelligent, and they even have a structure similar to the Eldonari within their chest, which we believe enables them to remain submerged for extended periods of time at great depth.
Can they breathe fire?
No, but like the Fanghur, they often use the power of their minds to incapacitate their prey, which more than one dragon has discovered to their dismay.
They would eat their own kind?
Saphira said.
To them, we are nothing alike,
Glaedah replied.
But they do eat their own, which is one reason there are so few Nidwala. They have no interest in happenings outside their own realm, and every attempt to reason with them has met with failure. It is odd to encounter one so close to shore. There was a time when they were only found several days' flight from land, where the sea is the deepest. It seems they have grown either bold or desperate since the fall of the Riders.
Aragorn shivered again, as he remembered the feel of the Nidwal's mind. Why did neither you nor Oromis ever teach us of them?
There is much we did not teach you, Aragorn. We had only so much time, and it was best spent trying to arm you against Galbatorix, not every dark creature that haunts the unexplored regions of Alagasia.
There are other things like the Nidwal that we don't know about?
A few. Will you tell us of them, Eberithil?
Saphira asked.
I will make a pact with you, Saphira, and with you, Aragorn. Let us wait a week, and if we are still alive and still possessed of our freedom, I will happily spend the next 10 years teaching you about every single race I know of, including every variety of beetle of which there are multitudes. But until then, let us concentrate upon the task before us. Are we agreed?
Aragorn and Saphira reluctantly agreed, and they spoke of it no more. The headwind strengthened into a blustery gale as they neared the front of the storm, slowing Saphira until she was flying at half her normal speed. Now and then, powerful gusts rocked her, and sometimes stopped her dead in her course for a few moments. They always knew when the gusts were about to strike, for they could see a silvery scale-like pattern rushing toward them across the surface of the water. Since dawn, the clouds had only increased in size, and up close, they were even more intimidating. Near the bottom, they were dark and purplish, with curtains of driving rain connecting the storm with the sea, like a gauzy umbilical cord. Higher up, the clouds were the colour of tarnished silver, while the very tops were a pure, blinding white, and appeared as solid as the flanks of Trondheim. To the north, over the centre of the storm, the clouds had formed a gigantic, flat-topped anvil that loomed over all else, as if the gods themselves intended to forge some strange and terrible instrument. As Sephira soared between two bulging white columns, beside which she was no more than a speck, and the sea vanished beneath a field of pillow-like clouds, the headwind abated, and the air grew rough and choppy, swirling about them without an identifiable direction. Aragorn clenched his teeth to keep them from clacking, and his stomach lurched as Sephira dropped a half-dozen feet, and then, just as quickly, rose more than 20 feet straight up. Glada said,
"Have you any experience storm-flying, other than the time you were caught in a thunderstorm between Palancar Valley and Yazwak?"
"No,"
said Sephira, short and grim. Glada seemed to have expected her answer, for without hesitation, he began to instruct her about the intricacies of navigating the fantastic cloudscape.
"Look for patterns of movement, and take note of the formations around you,"
he said.
"By them, you may guess where the wind is strongest and the direction it is blowing."
Much of what he said, Sephira already knew. But as Glada kept talking, the old dragon's calm demeanor steadied both her and Aragorn. Had they felt alarm or fear in the old dragon's mind, it would have caused them to doubt themselves. And perhaps Glada was aware of that. A stray, wind-torn scrap of cloud lay across Sephira's path. Instead of flying around it, she went straight through, piercing the cloud like a glittering blue spear. As the grey mist enveloped them, the sound of the wind grew muted, and Aragorn squinted and held a hand before his face to keep his eyes clear. When they shot out of the cloud, millions of tiny droplets clung to Sephira's body, and she sparkled as if diamonds had been affixed to her already dazzling scales. Her flight continued to be unsettled. One moment she would be level, but the next the unruly air might shove her sideways, or an unexpected updraft might lift one wing and send her slewing off in the opposite direction. Just sitting on her back as she fought against the turbulence was tiring, while for Sephira herself it was a miserable, frustrating struggle, made all the more difficult by knowing that it was far from over, and that she had no choice but to continue on. After an hour or two, they still had not sighted the far side of the tempest. Glada said,
"We have to turn. You've gone as far west as is prudent, and if we're to dare the full wrath of the storm, we had best do it now, before you are any more exhausted."
Without a word, Sephira wheeled north, toward the vast, towering cliff of sunlit clouds that occupied the heart of the giant storm. As they neared the ridged face of the cliff, which was the largest single thing Aragorn had ever seen, larger even than Farthendur, blue flashes illuminated the folds within as lightning crawled upward toward the top of the anvil head. A moment later, a clap of thunder shook the sky, and Aragorn covered his ears with his hands. He knew that his wards would protect them from the lightning, but he still felt apprehensive about venturing near the crackling bolts of energy. If Sephira was frightened, he did not sense it. All he could feel was her determination. She quickened the beat of her wings, and a few minutes later they arrived at the face of the cliff, and then plunged through it, and into the center of the storm. Twilight surrounded them, grey and featureless. It was as if the rest of the world had ceased to exist. The clouds made it impossible for Aragorn to judge any distance past the tips of Sephira's nose, tail, and wings. They were effectively blind, and only the constant pull of their weight let them differentiate up from down. Aragorn opened his mind and allowed his consciousness to expand as far as he could. But he felt no other living thing besides Saphira and Gleda, not even a single stray bird. Fortunately, Saphira retained her sense of direction, and they would not get lost. And by continuing to search with his mind for other beings, whether plant or animal, Aragorn could ensure that they would not fly straight into the side of a mountain. He also cast a spell that Oromis had taught him, a spell that informed him and Saphira exactly how close they were to the water or the ground at any given moment. From the moment they entered the cloud, the ever-present moisture began to accumulate on Aragorn's skin and soak into his woolen clothes, weighing them down. It was an annoyance he could have ignored, had not the combination of water and wind been so chilling. It would have soon drained the heat from his limbs and killed him. Therefore he cast another spell, which filtered the air around him of any visible droplets, as well as, at her request, the air around Saphira's eyes, for the moisture kept collecting on their surface, forcing her to blink all too frequently. The wind inside the anvil head was surprisingly gentle. Aragorn made a comment to that effect to Gleda, but the old dragon stayed as grim as ever.
"We have yet to encounter the worst of it."
The truth of his words soon became evident when a ferocious updraft slammed into Saphira's underside and carried her thousands of feet higher, where the air was too thin for Aragorn to breathe properly, and the mist froze into countless tiny crystals that stung his nose and cheeks, and the webbing of Saphira's wings, like so many razor-sharp knives. Pinning her wings against her sides, Saphira dove forward, trying to escape the updraft. After a few seconds, the pressure underneath her vanished, only to be replaced by an equally powerful downdraft, which shoved her toward the waves at a frightful speed. As they fell, the ice crystals melted, forming large globular raindrops that seemed to float weightlessly alongside Saphira. Lightning flared nearby, an eerie blue glow through the veil of clouds, and Aragorn shouted with pain as the thunder boomed around them. His ears still ringing, he ripped two small pieces off the edge of his cloak, then rolled up the scraps of cloth and screwed them into his ears, forcing them in as far as he could. Only near the bottom of the clouds did Saphira manage to break free of the fast-flowing stream of air. As soon as she did, a second updraft seized hold of her, and like a giant hand pushed her skyward. Then, and for a long while after, Aragorn lost all track of time. The raging wind was too strong for Saphira to resist, and she continued to rise and fall in the cycling air like a piece of flotsam caught in a whirlpool. She made some headway, a few scant miles, dearly won, and with great effort retained. But every time she extricated herself from one of the looping currents, she found herself trapped in another. It was humbling for Aragorn to realize that he, Saphira, and Gleda were helpless before the storm, and that for all their might, they could not hope to match the power of the elements. Twice the wind nearly drove Saphira into the crashing waves. On both occasions, the downdrafts cast her out of the underbelly of the storm into the squalls of rain that pummeled the sea below. The second time it happened, Aragorn looked over Saphira's shoulder, and for an instant he thought he saw the long, dark shape of the Nidhwal resting upon the heaving water. However, when the next burst of lightning came, the shape was gone, and he wondered whether the shadows had played a trick upon him. As Saphira's strength waned, she fought the wind less and less, and instead allowed it to take her where it would. She only made an effort to defy the storm when she got too close to the water. Otherwise, she stilled her wings and exerted herself as little as possible. Aragorn felt when Gleda began to feed her a thread of energy to help sustain her, but even that was not enough to allow her to do more than hold her place. Eventually, what light there was began to fade, and despair settled upon Aragorn. They had spent the better part of the day being tossed about by the storm, and still it showed no sign of subsiding, nor did it seem as if Saphira was anywhere close to its perimeter. Once the sun had set, Aragorn could not even see the tip of his nose, and there was no difference between when his eyes were open and when they were closed. It was as if a huge pile of black wool had been packed around him and Sapphira, and indeed the darkness seemed to have a weight to it, as if it were a palpable substance pressing against them from all sides. Every few seconds, another flash of lightning split the gloom, sometimes hidden within the clouds, sometimes streaking across their field of vision, glaring with the brightness of a dozen suns, and leaving the air tasting like iron. After the searing brightness of the closer discharges, the night seemed twice as dark, and Aragorn and Sapphira alternated between being blinded by the light and being blinded by the utter black that followed. As close as the bolts came, they never struck Sapphira, but the constant roll of thunder left Aragorn and Sapphira feeling sick from the noise. How long they continued like that, Aragorn could not tell. Then at some point in the night, Sapphira entered a torrent of rising air that was far larger and far stronger than any they had previously encountered. As soon as it struck them, Sapphira began to struggle against it in an attempt to escape. But the force of the wind was so great she could barely hold her wings level. At last, frustrated, she roared and loosed a jet of flame from her maw, illuminating a small area of the surrounding ice crystals, which glittered like gems.
"Help me,"
she said to Aragorn and Gleda.
"I can't do this by myself."
So the two of them melded their minds, and with Gleda supplying the needed energy, Aragorn shouted, "Gangar Fram!" The spell propelled Sapphira forward, but ever so slowly, for moving at right angles to the wind was like swimming across the Anora River during the height of the spring snowmelt. Even as Sapphira advanced horizontally, the current continued to sweep her upward at a dizzying rate. Soon Aragorn began to notice that he was growing short of breath, and yet they remained caught within the torrent of air.
"This is taking too long, and it's costing us too much energy," said Gleda. "End the spell."
"But..."
"End the spell. We can't win free before the two of you faint. We'll have to ride the wind until it weakens enough for Sapphira to escape."
"How?"
she asked, while Aragorn did as Gleda instructed. The exhaustion and sense of defeat that muddied her thoughts made Aragorn feel a pang of concern for her.
"Aragorn, you must amend the spell you are using to warm yourself to include Sapphira and me. It is going to grow cold, colder than even the bitterest winter in the spine, and without magic we shall freeze to death."
"Even you?"
"I will crack like a piece of hot glass dropped in snow. Next you must cast a spell to gather the air around you and Sapphira, and to hold it there so you may still breathe. But it must also allow the stale air to escape, or else you will suffocate. The wording of the spell is complicated, and you must not make any mistakes, so listen carefully. It goes as such."
Once Gleda had recited the necessary phrases in the ancient language, Aragorn repeated them back to him, and when the dragon was satisfied with his pronunciation, Aragorn cast the spell. Then he amended his other piece of magic, as Gleda had instructed, so the three of them were shielded from the cold. They waited then, while the wind lifted them higher and higher. Minutes passed, and Aragorn began to wonder if they would ever stop, or if they would keep hurtling upward until they were level with the moon and the stars. It occurred to him that perhaps this was how shooting stars were made. A bird or a dragon or some other earthly creature, snatched upward by the inexorable wind and thrown skyward with such speed they flamed like siege arrows. If so, then he guessed he, Sapphira, and Gleda would make the brightest, most spectacular shooting star in living memory, if anyone was close enough to see their demise so far out to sea. The howling of the wind gradually grew softer. Even the bone-jarring claps of thunder seemed muted, and when Aragorn dug the scraps of cloth out of his ears, he was astonished by the hushed silence that surrounded them. He still heard a faint susurration in the background, like the sound of a small forest brook, but other than that, it was quiet. blessedly quiet. As the clamour of the angry storm faded, he also noticed that the strain imposed by his spells was increasing, not so much from the enchantment that prevented their bodily heat from dissipating too quickly, but from the enchantment that collected and compressed the atmosphere in front of him and Sephira, so that they could fill their lungs as they normally did. For whatever reason, the energy required to maintain the second spell multiplied out of all proportion to the first, and he soon felt the symptoms that indicated the magic was upon the verge of stealing away what little remained of his life force. A coldness of his hands, an uncertainty in the beating of his heart, and an overwhelming sense of lethargy, which was perhaps the most worrying sign of all. Then Glada began to assist him. With relief, Aragorn felt his burden decrease as the dragon's strength flowed into him. A flush of fever-like heat that washed away his lethargy and restored the vigour of his limbs. And so they continued. At long last, Sephira detected a slackening of the wind, slight but noticeable, and she began to prepare to fly out of the stream of air. Before she could, the clouds above them thinned, and Aragorn glimpsed a few glittering specks, stars white and silvery, and brighter than any he had seen before.
"Look," he said.
Then the clouds opened up around them, and Sephira rose out of the storm and hung above it, balancing precariously atop the column of rushing wind. Laid out below them, Aragorn saw the whole of the storm, extending for what must have been 100 miles in every direction. The centre appeared as an arching mushroom-like dome, smoothed off by the vicious crosswinds that swept from west to east and threatened to topple Sephira from her uncertain perch. The clouds, both near and far, were milky and seemed almost luminous, as if lit from within. They looked beautiful and benign, placid, unchanging formations that betrayed nothing of the violence inside. Then Aragorn noticed the sky, and he gasped, for it contained more stars than he had thought existed. Red, blue, white, gold, they lay strewn upon the firmament, like handfuls of sparkling dust. The constellations he was familiar with were still present, but now set among thousands of fainter stars, which he beheld for the very first time. And not only did the stars appear brighter, the void between them appeared darker. It was as if whenever he had looked at the sky before, there had been a haze over his eyes that had kept him from seeing the true glory of the stars. He stared at the spectacular display for several moments, awestruck by the glorious, random, unknowable nature of the twinkling lights. Only when he finally lowered his gaze did it occur to him that there was something unusual about the purple-hued horizon. Instead of the sky and the sea meeting in a straight line, as they ought to, and always had before, the juncture between them curved, like the edge of an unimaginably big circle. It was such a strange sight, it took Aragorn 6 seconds to understand what he was seeing. And when he did, his scalp tingled, and he felt as if the breath had been knocked out of him.
"The world is round," he whispered. "The sky is hollow, and the world is round."
"So it would appear,"
Glada said, but he seemed equally impressed.
"I heard tell of this from a wild dragon, but I never thought to see it myself."
To the east, a faint yellow glow tinted a section of the horizon, presaging the return of the sun. Aragorn guessed that if Sephira held her position for another 4 or 5 minutes, they would see it rise, even though it would still be hours before the warm, life-giving rays reached the water below. Sephira balanced there for a moment more, the three of them suspended between the stars and the earth, floating in the silent twilight, like dispossessed spirits. They were in a nowhere place, neither part of the heavens nor part of the world below. A moat, passing through the margin, separating two immensities. Then Sapphira tipped forward, and half flew, half fell northward, for the air was so sparse that her wings could not fully support her weight, once she left the stream of rising wind. As she hurtled downward, Aragorn said, "If we had enough jewels, and if we stored enough energy in them, do you think we could fly all the way to the moon?"
"Who knows what is possible," said Gleider.
When Aragorn was a child, Carvajal and the Palancar Valley had been all he had known. He had heard of the Empire, of course, but it had never seemed quite real until he began to travel within it. Later still, his mental picture of the world had expanded to include the rest of Alagasia, and vaguely the other lands he had read of. And now he realized that what he had thought of as so large was actually but a small part of a much greater whole. It was as if his point of view had within a few seconds gone from that of an ant to that of an eagle. For the sky was hollow, and the world was round. It made him re-evaluate and re-categorize everything. The war between the Varden and the Empire seemed inconsequential when compared with the true size of the world, and he thought how petty were most of the hurts and concerns that bedeviled people when looked at from on high. To Sapphira, he said, "If only everyone could see what we have seen, perhaps there would be less fighting in the world."
"You cannot expect wolves to become sheep."
"No, but neither do the wolves have to be cruel to the sheep." Sapphira soon dropped back into the darkness of the clouds, but she managed to avoid getting caught in another cycle of rising and falling air. Instead, she glided for many miles, skipping off the tops of the other lower updrafts packed within the storm, using them to help conserve her strength. An hour or two later, the fog parted, and they flew out of the huge mass of clouds that formed the center of the storm. They descended to skim over the insubstantial foothills piled about its base, which gradually flattened into a quilted blanket that covered everything in sight, with the sole exception of the anvil head itself. By the time the sun finally appeared above the horizon, neither Aragorn nor Sapphira had the energy to pay much attention to their surroundings, nor was there anything in the sameness below to attract their attention. It was Gleider then who said,
"Sapphira, there, to your right. Do you see it?"
Aragorn lifted his head off his folded arms and squinted as his eyes adjusted to the brightness. Some miles to the north, a ring of mountains rose out of the clouds. The peaks were clad in snow and ice, and together they looked like an ancient jagged crown resting atop the layers of mist. The eastward-facing scarps shone brilliantly in the light of the morning sun, while long blue shadows cloaked the western sides and stretched dwindling into the distance, tenebrous daggers upon the billowy snow-white plain. Aragorn straightened in his seat, hardly daring to believe that their journey might be at an end.
"Behold," said Gleider, "Arras Thelduin, the fire mountains that guard the heart of Vroengard. Fly quickly, Sapphira, for we have but a little farther to go."
Burrow Grubs. They caught her at the intersection of two identical corridors, both lined with pillars and torches, and scarlet pennants bearing the twisting gold flame that was Galbatorix's insignia. Nasawada had not expected to escape, not really, but she could not help but feel disappointed at her failure. If nothing else, she had hoped to cover more distance before they recaptured her. She fought the whole way, as the soldiers dragged her back to the chamber that had been her prison. The men wore chest plates and vambraces, but she still managed to scratch their faces and bite their hands, wounding a pair of the men rather severely. The soldiers uttered exclamations of dismay when they entered the hall of the soothsayer and saw what she had done to her jailer. Careful not to step in the pooling blood, they carried her to the slab of stone, strapped her down, then hurried away, leaving her alone with the corpse. She shouted at the ceiling and yanked at her restraints, angry with herself for not having done better. Still simmering, she glanced at the body on the floor, then quickly looked away. In death, the man's expression seemed accusatory, and she could not bear to gaze upon it. After she stole the spoon, she had spent hours grinding the end of the handle against the stone slab. The spoon had been made of soft iron, so it was easy to shape. She had thought that Galbatorix and Murtagh would visit her next, but instead it was her jailer, bringing her what might have been a late dinner. He had started to undo her manacles in preparation for escorting her to the privy room. The moment he freed her left hand, she stabbed him underneath the chin with the sharpened handle of the spoon, burying the utensil in the folds of his wattle. The man squealed a horrible, high-pitched sound that reminded her of a pig at slaughter, and spun thrice around, flailing his arms, then fell to the floor, where he lay thrashing and frothing and drumming his heels for what seemed an unreasonably long time. Killing him had troubled her. She did not think the man had been evil. She was not sure what he had been. But there had been a simpleness to him that made her feel as if she had taken advantage. Still, she had done what was necessary, and though she now found it unpleasant to consider, she remained convinced that her actions had been justified. As the man lay convulsing in his death throes, she had unfastened the rest of the restraints and jumped off the slab. Then, steeling her nerve, she pulled the spoon out of the man's neck, which, like a stopper removed from the bung of a barrel, released a spray of blood that splattered her legs and caused her to jump backward while stifling a curse. The two guards outside the hall of the soothsayer had been easy enough to deal with. She had caught them by surprise and killed the right-hand guard in much the same way she had killed her jailer. Then she had drawn the dagger from the guard's belt and attacked the other man, even as he struggled to bring his pike to bear upon her. Up close, a pike was no match for a dagger, and she had unseamed him before he had a chance to escape or raise the alarm. She had not gotten very far after that, whether because of Galbatorix's spells or just plain bad luck. She ran headlong into a group of 5 soldiers, and they had quickly, if not easily, subdued her. It could not have been more than 30 minutes later when she heard a large group of men in iron-shod boots march up to the door of the chamber, and then Galbatorix stormed in, followed by several guards. As always, he stopped at the edge of her line of sight, and there he stood, a tall, dark figure with an angular face, only the outlines of which were visible. She saw his head turn as he took in the scene. Then in a cold voice he said, "How did this happen?" A soldier with a plume on his helm scurried in front of Galbatorix, knelt, and held out her sharpened spoon. "Sire, we found this in one of the men outside." The king took the spoon and turned it over in his hands.
"I see."
His head swiveled toward her. He gripped the ends of the spoon, and without discernible effort, bent it until it snapped in two.
"You knew you could not escape, and yet you insisted upon trying. I'll not have you killing my men merely to spite me. You have not the right to take their lives. You have not the right to do anything unless I allow it."
He flung the pieces of metal upon the floor. Then he turned and stalked out of the hall of the soothsayer, his heavy cape flapping behind him. 2 of the soldiers removed her jailer's body, then scoured the chamber of his blood, cursing her as they scrubbed. Once they had left, and she was again alone, she allowed herself a sigh, and some of the tension in her limbs vanished. She wished she had had a chance to eat, for now that the excitement was over, she found she was hungry. Worse, she suspected she would have to wait hours before she could hope to have her next meal, assuming that Galbatorix did not decide to punish her by withholding food. Her musings about bread and roasts and tall glasses of wine were short-lived, as she again heard the sound of many boots in the passageway outside her cell. Startled, she tried to mentally prepare herself for whatever unpleasantness was about to come, for it would be unpleasant, she was sure. The door to the chamber crashed open, and two sets of footsteps echoed in the octagonal room as Murtagh and Galbatorix walked over to her. Murtagh positioned himself where he usually did, but without the brazier to occupy himself, he crossed his arms, leaned against the wall, and glared at the floor. What she could see of his expression beneath his silver half-mask did not comfort her. The lines of his face seemed even harder than normal, and there was something about the cast of his mouth that sent a chill of fear into her bones. Instead of sitting, as was his wont, Galbatorix stood behind and somewhat to the side of her head, where she could feel his presence more than she could see it. He extended his long, claw-like hands over her. In them he held a small box, decorated with lines of carved horn that might have formed glyphs from the ancient language. Most disconcerting of all, a faint "scree, scree" sound came from within the container, soft as the scratching of a mouse, but no less distinct. With the pad of his thumb, Galbatorix pushed open the box's sliding lid. Then he reached inside and pulled out what appeared to be a large, ivory-coloured maggot. The creature was almost 3 inches long, and it had a tiny mouth at one end, with which it uttered the "scree, scree" she had heard before, announcing its displeasure to the world. It was plump and pleated, like a caterpillar, but if it had any legs, they were so small as to be invisible. As the creature wiggled in a vain attempt to free itself from between Galbatorix's fingers, the king said, "This is a burrow grub. It is not what it appears to be. Few things are, but in the case of burrow grubs, that is all the more true. They are found in only one place in Alagasia, and are far more difficult to capture than you might suppose. Take it, then, as a sign of my regard for you, Nasawada, daughter of Arjahad, that I deign to use one on you." His voice dropped in tone, becoming even more intimate. "I would not, however, wish to exchange places with you." The "scree, scree" of the burrow grub increased in volume as Galbatorix dropped it onto the bare skin of her right arm, just below the elbow. She flinched as the disgusting creature landed on her. It was heavier than it looked, and its underside gripped her with what felt like hundreds of little hooks. The burrow grub squalled for a moment more, then it gathered up its body in a tight bundle and hopped several inches up her arm. She wrenched at her bonds, hoping to dislodge the grub, but it continued to cling to her. Again it hopped. And again. And now it was on her shoulder, the hooks pinching and digging into her skin like a strip of minute cockle burrs. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw the burrow grub lift up its eyeless head and point it toward her face, as if testing the air. Its tiny mouth opened, and she saw that it had sharp, cutting mandibles behind its upper and lower lips.
"Scree, scree,"
said the burrow grub.
"Scree, scra."
"Not there," Galbatorix said, and he spoke a word in the ancient language. On hearing it, the burrow grub swung away from her head, for which she felt a measure of relief. Then it began to worm its way back down her arm. Few things frightened her. The touch of the hot iron frightened her. The thought that Galbatorix might reign forevermore in Urabane frightened her. Death, of course, frightened her, although not so much because she feared the end of her existence, as because she feared leaving undone all the things she still hoped to accomplish. But for whatever